Imagine living in a world where half the population is legally owned by the other half upon marriage, where your education, career options, and even thoughts are deliberately limited based on your gender. This was the reality John Stuart Mill confronted in 1869 with The Subjection of Women, a text so revolutionary that it was initially dismissed as dangerous extremism. Written in collaboration with his wife, Harriet Taylor Mill, this work didn't just advocate for women's rights, it fundamentally challenged how society understood human potential and freedom itself. Within 50 years, many of its radical proposals became reality. What made this Victorian-era text so powerful was its systematic dismantling of the arguments used to justify women's subordination, arguments that still echo in corners of society today. The legal subordination of women began with primitive force that evolved into tradition. This system endures through sentiment rather than logic, making it resistant to evidence. We mistake the familiar for natural. Southern slaveholders claimed white dominance was natural order, while Aristotle believed some were born for freedom, others for slavery. Every power system presents itself as inevitable rather than constructed. Institutions founded on force persist even after their justification disappears. Male dominance uniquely benefits half the population, with men exercising power in intimate spheres where women live under surveillance with limited ability to organize. Most revealing is how natural domination feels to those possessing it. Throughout history, what appears natural is merely customary, a product of specific historical circumstances, not immutable human nature. This psychological mechanism operates whenever one group holds power over another, making change seem impossible until suddenly it isn't. Claims about women being naturally emotional or inherently nurturing are meaningless since we've only observed women under male control. Women's character has been artificially constructed by cultivating traits beneficial to men while stunting others. This shaping begins in childhood and continues throughout life. Men mistake their own handiwork for natural growth, like gardeners who prune a tree into an unnatural shape, then declare it the tree's natural form. We attribute to nature what clearly results from circumstances, just as Irish indolence was once attributed to national character rather than colonial policies, we mistake effects of women's social position for inherent qualities. Women have given little genuine testimony about their mental characteristics, constrained by social expectations. Even husbands rarely know their wives' true minds, as wives maintain careful facades due to their subordinate position. From infancy, women learn their ideal character is submission, not self-governance. All morality teaches them to live for others, first fathers, then husbands and sons. With attraction, economic dependence, and social ambition accessible only through men, attractiveness becomes the polar star of feminine education. Women are shaped to fit male preferences, then praised for displaying the very qualities they were forced to develop. Despite being women's appointed destination, marriage has been made unnecessarily unfavorable. A wife must vow lifelong obedience and cannot take legal action independently. Any property she brings to marriage or acquires during it instantly becomes her husband's, a position more restrictive than Roman slaves who could maintain personal property. The legal fiction that husband and wife are one person operates entirely to women's disadvantage. This unity only makes her property his, never the reverse. His legal responsibility resembles a master's liability for slaves, maintaining control while protecting others from the dependent party. Though wives generally receive better material treatment than slaves, their bondage is more complete. Most slaves have defined tasks and personal time, while wives remain perpetually under obligation. A wife has no legal rights over her children, who belong exclusively to her husband. She cannot leave without abandoning everything, as he can legally force her return or seize her earnings. Defenders often point to good husbands as justification, but these mitigations merely demonstrate human capacity to resist evil institutions, just as benevolent monarchs don't justify despotism. The legal structure remains fundamentally oppressive, regardless of individual variations. How can society exist without government? In families, as in states, someone must make final decisions when opinions differ. Yet voluntary associations don't require absolute masters. Business partnerships establish terms through mutual agreement, not by designating a supreme ruler. Daily decisions may need one person's control, but not always the same person. One spouse might lead on finances while the other manages household operations. The natural arrangement divides powers between spouses, with major changes requiring mutual consent. Decision-making influence naturally follows comparative qualifications: age, financial contribution, mental capability, and character strength. These factors allocate influence without legal compulsion. Marriages only resort to power dynamics when the partnership has fundamentally failed. The law's despotic framework, giving husbands absolute authority while wives have nothing, creates an unjust foundation. Any concessions remain precarious, fostering insecurity rather than trust. The most successful marriages demonstrate that shared governance creates stronger unions, recognizing both partners' capabilities while providing frameworks for resolving disagreements, similar to how modern couples divide responsibilities based on individual strengths rather than gender. The historical success of female rulers thoroughly demolishes arguments about women's political incapacity. Queens like Catherine the Great and Elizabeth I demonstrated remarkable governance talent, often displaying firmness that contradicts stereotypes. The criticism that queens rely on male advisors misunderstands leadership. Selecting capable ministers is itself a crucial governance skill, reflecting women's insight into character. Most great queens succeeded through their own talents and independent decision-making. Royal women succeed because they receive intellectual freedom similar to men. Unlike other women of their eras, princesses aren't taught that politics is improper. They're educated in statecraft comparable to male heirs. Women's talents tend toward the practical rather than theoretical, often advantageous in governance. Their capacity for intuitive perception gives them rapid insight into present facts rather than abstract principles. When equally educated, women often demonstrate superior practical judgment by seeing what's actually before them rather than what theory dictates. The first advantage of equality would be governing the most universal human relation by justice rather than injustice. Boys grow up believing their maleness makes them superior to half of humanity, including women whose superiority they may witness daily. The subjection of women contradicts modern moral principles that conduct, not birth, determines respect. As long as force rules in the very heart of society, broader equality remains difficult. The second benefit would be doubling humanity's mental faculties. Women's talents are severely limited despite their domestic management skills. Men would also benefit from genuine competition. Beyond personal dignity, lack of worthy outlets devastates happiness. While family cares suffice for many women, they face a void when children grow or die, like retired businessmen who wither without purpose. Women's liberation is about human advancement, not just women's rights. Removing artificial barriers enriches society with untapped intelligence and creativity. The question isn't whether women can equal men, but how much higher humanity might rise when all minds contribute their unique perspectives to our collective future.